Welcome to What the Paper Said, in which I, Patrick Crozier, skim through the Times from 100 years ago, read some of the articles and comment on the ones I find interesting. In this episode, the week ending the 2nd of March 1924, Hitler and High Treason. But first, some of the other items that have caught my attention this week. The dock strike that began last week has come to an end. The Soviets have been celebrating the 6th anniversary of the foundation of the Red Army. But there is a bit more to it, as the Times puts it. It is significant that beyond the publication of a portrait of Trotsky, accompanied by a long bulletin on his health, no mention was made of the important part played by him in the creation of the Red Army. Further evidence that Trotsky has lost the power struggle before it has even started. But at least he is somewhere near the levers of power, which is more than can be said for Winston Churchill. Everybody knows about Churchill's time as Prime Minister. What they tend not to know is that he was a Conservative before becoming a Liberal, before becoming a Conservative again. That last move is going to happen quite soon, and Churchill is on manoeuvres. In a letter to a Conservative by-election candidate, published on the 1st of March, he had this to say. Now that the fiscal question has been decided by the late election, he means tariffs, there is no difference of principle which separates Liberals and Conservatives. When he does stand, he may find a changed electorate. As things stand, all men over the age of 21 can vote. So can women over the age of 30 with a property qualification. A private member's bill is proposing to equalise the franchise, so that everyone over the age of 21 can vote regardless of sex or property. On Friday, the bill received its second reading. In other words, the principle of the bill has been accepted. But, spoiler alert, it won't become law, or at least not by the time of the next general election, which, second spoiler alert, will be taking place this year. There's been an extraordinary case before the courts. A man who was confined in a lunatic asylum for 9 years, only to escape and be found sane, has sued the two doctors who certified him and won damages of £25,000. That's about £3 million today. The shocker to come out of this is that once a person is committed, there is no procedure to check that he is still insane. I say a shocker, but the other one is if the man, Harness is his name, had not escaped, he would still be inside. In the 16th of December episode, I covered the outbreak of foot and mouth disease. That's still going on, despite the best efforts of the government, or perhaps even because of them, with another 18 incidences reported this week. Following last week's announcement of Arnold Yarrow's plan to build a flyover at Oxford Circus, a correspondent has chipped in with the idea of a pedestrian subway. I'm sure it sounded like a good idea at the time. Actually, nowadays there is a pedestrian subway in the form of the entrances to Oxford Circus station, but it occurs to me that pedestrian subways in crowded areas are fine. The problem is when they are empty and provide a haunt for thieves. Thursday's edition featured an ad from the then privately owned coal industry. It had this rather prophetic statement. Before the presently available deposits can be exhausted, hundreds of years must elapse. It is certain that in the interval other sources of energy will be discovered, rendering coal mining unprofitable. Well, in this country at least. A bit odd for an industry association to say we're doomed. Long ago, I did wonder if the tedium of a train journey might be relieved if radio was broadcast in the carriages. I thought I'd come up with an original idea. It would appear that I hadn't. The Great Western Railway were conducting just such an experiment this week. Mind you, it occurs to me that the Performing Rights Society might have something to say about this. General Sir Ian Hamilton was the commander of land operations during the Gallipoli debacle. My guess is that he was handed an impossible job, although other opinions are available. It would appear that there were plenty of people who agree with him. On Monday the 25th, the Times reported on a speech he had given at the weekend, chaired, oddly enough, by Winston Churchill, mastermind of that particular debacle, in which he had this suggestion to make. If this country cut down 2/3 of the infantry and put the others into tanks and mechanical transport, he would undertake to say that the war value of divisions would be equal at least, he thought more, to what it was today, while 1 year's saving on the pay of the men and the maintenance would pay for the tanks and other machines. It would be a very great and real economy, by perfecting armaments, not by an increase of armaments. They did their best to try to help science to make war unthinkable. He hoped that a pitch of perfection would come in aeroplanes and tanks, when it would be obviously silly for anyone to go to war. Was he right? Certainly tanks and planes were incredibly important in the Second World War, although tanks needed infantry support. And as the Germans found out with the King Tiger tank, the ME-262 and the V-2 rocket, quality is not necessarily a match for quantity. And it was certainly no deterrent. But as far as concentrating on tanks goes, Duffer General Hamilton is clearly on the right lines. On Thursday, the Times reported on a conference on vagrancy. Speakers kept on mentioning something called a casual ward. At first I thought that had something to do with local government, but in fact a casual ward is, or was, a government-provided shelter for a tramp. But with a couple of unusual features. First, they were locked in, it was effectively a cell, and secondly, they could only spend one night there. After that, they had to tramp to another casual ward. Reporting on a speech by a Reverend W. Mahon, the Times said this: "He was afraid the tramp would always be with us." I saw this in Friday's edition. At Newcastle Assizes yesterday, James Bell, 21, bricklayer, was found guilty of having robbed with violence a girl named Jenny Shanks while on her way home from work at a factory, and was sentenced to 1 month's imprisonment, during which he should receive 25 strokes of the birch rod. Yes, corporal punishment was a thing in those days. A couple of weeks ago, I mentioned an acid attack. The case has now come to a close. This is also from Friday the 29th. At the Central Criminal Court yesterday, Edith Louisa Bassett, 30, was found guilty of throwing corrosive fluid upon Arthur William Thompson and upon three other persons with intent to do grievous bodily harm to Thompson. Mr. Justice Shearman sentenced her to 3 years penal servitude. So far, so normal. Well, normalish. It's what comes next that had my eyes on stalks. After the jury had found the prisoner guilty, Inspector Aldridge said she had a remarkable history. Throughout her life, she had been of a violent disposition. In 1905, she was sentenced to 12 months hard labour for wounding with intent to murder. In 1905, this lady would have been at most 12 years old. She had made the acquaintance of an omnibus driver, and one night after he had stated that he wished to have nothing more to do with her, she went on the top of his omnibus and cut his throat with a razor. I'll overlook the apparent physical impossibility of such an act. In 1910, she married a man named Bassett. The marriage proved an unhappy one, and the husband joined the Navy. In other words, he ran away to sea in search of a quieter life. She next met a wealthy young man, and saying that she was the daughter of a retired doctor, persuaded him to go through the ceremony of marriage with her. She was charged with bigamy and bound over. Later she went to Scotland and assaulted a gentleman whose son, she said, had failed to carry out his promise to marry her. The prisoner in 1914 was sentenced to 12 months imprisonment with hard labour at the Central Criminal Court for perjury in the name of Melville. In that case, she had borrowed a person's baby to obtain an affiliation order against a man. In 1915, she made the acquaintance of an army officer and told him that her father was a ranch owner in Mexico and induced him to marry her. She also married another officer, and in that case borrowed a baby to work on the generosity of the officer's parents. For that bigamy she was sentenced to 18 months imprisonment. That's a high bar for criminality, but she's not the worst, not even this week. The trial of Adolf Hitler, Erich von Ludendorff, and a few others on charges of high treason arising out of November's Beer Hall Putsch has begun in Munich. This is what the Times had to say by way of preview. The reaction in favour of Hitler and Ludendorff, which began immediately after the failure of their attempt to seize power in Bavaria, has steadily increased until today. If a plebiscite were to be taken in Bavaria on the question whether Hitler should be released and Herr von Kahr, who was dictator at the time of the putsch, arraigned instead on a charge of treachery, there is no doubt that at least 80% of the population would vote in Hitler's favour. I was going to ask whether any candidate or proposition had ever got 80% in a democracy. And then I remembered the Saar plebiscite of 1935. The Saar had been under a League of Nations mandate since the end of the war, and Saarlanders were given the option to rejoin Germany. 90% of them voted to do so. This, remember, was Hitler's Germany after the Night of the Long Knives. They knew what they were signing up for. Back to the trial. The former chief of Munich police gave us a pretty good idea about Nazi obsessions. As for Herr von Pirner, the opening sentence of his declaration may be left to stand without comment. When the so-called revolution broke out, he means the revolution of November 1918, which overthrew the Kaiser, that crime against German people, undertaken by people of alien race, supported by international Jewish Freemasonry, I saw many officials and officers taking sides with acrobatic speed, crawling on their faces before Jews. The Times couldn't comment then, and I can't comment now. Extraordinary. Here's another conspirator from Friday. Colonel Kriebel mentioned, with some pride, that as his train was leaving Spa, in Belgium at the end of the war, he leaned out of the window and, shaking his fist at the city, shouted, "Auf Wiedersehen! Wait only a few years!" But this week's star was General Erich von Ludendorff, Germany's effective military chief in the last 2 years of the war. For over 3 hours during the afternoon, General Ludendorff reviewed political events since and during the war. As regards the monarchy, General Ludendorff declared, "I am a monarchist, but monarchy must be for the benefit of the people, and not the people for the monarchy." What sort of monarchy is that? He goes on. A considerable part of his speech was devoted to showing that the Roman Catholics were responsible for many of Germany's and especially Prussia's misfortunes. More scapegoats. On several occasions he referred to Hitler in most cordial, almost affectionate terms, and evidently held the opinion that the Hitler movement was the only one to be supported by those who were working for the Restoration. And he had this to say about what would have happened if von Kahr had not put down the rebellion. The patriotic organisations were so strong throughout the country that the movement must almost certainly have succeeded. Obviously we'll never know, but the conditions were very good. Maybe they still are. For the first time since the beginning of the trial, there was a demonstration outside the army school, and General Ludendorff was very heartily cheered as he drove away. Luckily, as the Times pointed out in an editorial, there is little to worry about just yet. No thoughtful person can imagine that Germany will be in a position to attack France for many years to come. Anyway, that's all for this week. I aim to have something up next week, but I promise nothing.